Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh. Hey!
Jingle bells, Batman smelt, Robin laid an egg. The Batmobile lost the wheel, and the Joker got away.
Christmas is over, yet I'm still reeling from Frank Sinatra's Let It Snow and Feliz Navidad. I don't know what it's like in other countries, but in the US, the month of December is dedicated to red and white bunting, peppermint-flavored everything, and Christmas songs, all month long. Maybe the music has made me go a little crazy, so as my opening music suggests, this month, I've decided to focus on the devil. The devil isn't just a fiery hell demon with horns and a pitchfork. See, when Christianity spread around the world, folk beliefs and traditions mixed in with it, gave it new flavor, changed it in subtle yet distinctive ways. One of the cooler ways Christianity changed was that the devil got a whole lot of new characterizations. So this month, we're going to go around the world and look at Maximon, a Guatemalan saint who's a mixture of the devil, Judas, Hernan Cortez, and a Mayan god, Mom. Then we're going to see how the devil influenced 200 years of Russian literature. And finally, we're going to look at voodoo, which gets mistaken for devil worship, but it really isn't. And of course, we'll talk about the Joker.
This is the Asymptote Podcast. I'm Daniel Goulden. Before we begin, I'd like to tell everyone that the deadline for Close Approximations, our translation contest, has been moved to February 1st. There are $4,500 in prizes, and it is being judged by Michael Hoffman, Ottilie Mulzet, and Marguerite Jewel Costa. We hope you enter. So with all this Star Wars mania going around, I'd like to remind everyone that Luke Skywalker was not Mark Hamill's finest role. His acting skills truly shined when he voiced the Joker in the mid-90s cartoon Batman, the animated series. That's his voice you hear at the beginning of this podcast. And I bring up the Joker not because of my undying love for Batman, but because he's actually a pretty good metaphor for the devil. Sure, he's evil, but he also changes depending on who's writing him and or playing him. In the 1960s TV show, he was comic relief, played by comedian Cesar Romero. In the 90s Tim Burton Batman movie, he was a sadistic clown, played by Jack Nicholson. In the 2000s, in Christopher Nolan's Dark Knight, Heath Ledger plays him as a terrorist who's not so much funny as he is, well, terrifying. But through all of these changes, the Joker is still recognizable as the Joker. His form may change, but his content remains the same. The devil is kind of like that. Okay, so in high school I was really into these little cartoons called Chick Tracks. No, they're not what you think. They're these religious pamphlets published by a guy named Jack Chick, and they're ridiculous. There are cartoons about how all Catholics secretly answer to the Pope, how foreign aid organizations are evil because they care more about feeding the hungry than converting them, about how Jews killed Jesus. I found them hilarious. And these things are everywhere. I found them in cities all across America, lying on the sidewalk, on public benches, being handed out on street corners. I actually found one the other day on the subway. I'm holding it now. It's about 5 centimeters tall, 8 centimeters wide. The paper is cheap and smells acidic. This one is pretty tame. It tells the story of Jesus and asks you to convert, but one of my favorites, one of the more ridiculous ones, tells the story of a teenager who plays Dungeons & Dragons, a nerdy role-playing game, and ends up being seduced by Satanism. It was funny because I had friends who played Dungeons & Dragons, and it wasn't so much devil worship as it was a great way to spend your Saturday night in a basement. I think the reason I found these cartoons so funny is because they were so over the top, so convinced of their righteousness, so unsubtle in their attempts at conversion. And the devil in these tracks was always portrayed as a horned monster with a forked tail trying to pull people off the path of good. He was a poorly written character, but that's our stereotypical image of him. So before we look at how the devil was portrayed around the world, I want to look at that stereotypical image. I want to see where it comes from. So where does the devil come from? The first mention of any character resembling the devil is a character called Ha-Satan in the book of Job. Ha, the,
Satan, adversary. This is where the word Satan comes from.
A man there was in the land of Uz, Job his name. And the man was blameless and upright and feared God and shunned evil. And 7 sons were born to him and 3 daughters. And his flocks came to 7,000 sheep and 3,000 camels and 500 yokes of cattle and 500 she-asses and a great abundance of slaves. And that man was greater than all the dwellers of the east, and his sons would go and hold a feast in each one's house on his set day, and they would call to their sisters to eat and drink with them. And it happened when the days of the feast came round, that Job would send and consecrate them and rise early in the morning and offer up burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job thought, "Perhaps my sons have offended and cursed God in their hearts." Thus would Job do at all times. And one day the sons of God came to stand in attendance before the Lord, and the adversary too came among them. And the Lord said to the adversary, "From where do you come?" And the adversary answered the Lord and said, "From roaming the earth and walking about in it." And the Lord said to the adversary, "Have you paid heed to my servant Job? For there is none like him on earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and shuns evil." And the adversary answered the Lord and said, "Does Job fear for nothing? Have you not hedged him, and his household, and all that he has all around? The work of his hands you have blessed, and his flock have spread over the land. And yet, reach out your hand, pray, and strike all he has. Will he not curse you to your face?" And the Lord said to the adversary, "Look, all that he has is in your hands. Only against him do not reach out your hand." And the adversary went out from before the Lord's presence.
Okay, first some theological background. Judaism started out as a polytheistic religion, until the main god Yahweh began being worshipped exclusively, and the religion became monotheistic. But those vestiges of polytheism can still be seen in parts of the Bible, and the book of Job is no exception. The sons of God standing in attendance before him, that basically comes from a council of gods, think Mount Olympus. And Ha-Satan, the adversary, is part of this council. He was probably originally a god in his own right, but has now been demoted to the status of angelish thing. And he's not really evil. He plays devil's advocate, pardon the pun, I couldn't resist, but God orders him to destroy Job's life. The Old Testament doesn't really have a conception of hell, but Jesus' teachings do. So in the New Testament, the devil emerges as a fallen angel who rebelled against God, and now is the ruler of hell, where sinners go for punishment.
"He that heareth you heareth me, and he that despiseth you despiseth me, and he that despiseth me despiseth him that sent me." And the 70 returned again with joy, saying, "Lord, even the devils are subject unto us through thy name." And he said unto them, "I beheld Satan as lightning fall from heaven. Behold, I give unto you power to tread on serpents and scorpions and over all the power of the enemy, and nothing shall by any means hurt you."
Okay, so the story laid out in the New Testament is this. Lucifer was an angel and an all-around great guy, but then he decides to lead a rebellion of angels against God. The archangel Michael leads an army of good angels against him, defeats him, and casts him out of heaven down into hell. Writers had a field day with this story, and we're going to look at one notable example of a writer who contributed to the image of the devil as the fiery king of hell, Dante. At the crossroads of his life, in exile for supporting the wrong guy's medieval Florentine politics, Dante Alighieri wrote the Divine Comedy, a story of his purported travels through hell, purgatory, and heaven. His first book, Inferno, tells the story of his journeys through hell, led by the poet Virgil. It's a disturbing book, full of images of rotting bodies, cities of death and refuse, souls damned to suffer in an eternal hailstorm. But my favorite part is the end, when Dante gazes upon the devil himself, an inferno called Beelzebub.
"The emperor of the realm of grief protruded from mid-breast up above the surrounding ice. A giant's height in mine would have provided closer comparison than would the size of his arm in a giant. Envision the whole that is proportionate to parts like these. If he was truly once as beautiful as he is ugly now, and raised his brows against his maker, Then all sorrow may well come out of him. How great a marvel it was for me to see three faces on his head. In front there was a red one, joined to this, each over the midpoint of a shoulder. He had two others, all three joining at the crown. That on the right appeared to be a shade of whitish yellow. The third had such a mien as those who come from where the Nile descends. Two wings spread forth from under each face's chin. Strong and befitting such a bird, immense, I have never seen at sea so broad a sail, unfeathered, bat-like, and issuing three winds that went forth as he beat them to freeze the whole realm of cocytus that surrounded him. He wept with all six eyes, and the tears fell over his three chins mingled with bloody foam. The teeth of each mouth held a sinner, kept as by a flax rake. Thus he held three of them in agony. For the one the front mouth gripped, the teeth were as nothing to the claws which sliced and tore the skin until his back was stripped. "That soul," my master said, "who suffers most is Judas Iscariot. Head locked inside, he flails his legs. Of the other two, who twist with their heads down, the black mouth holds the shade of Brutus, writhing, but not a word will he scream. Cassius is the sinewy one on the other side."
Here the devil is suffering right alongside Cassius, Brutus, and Judas. Frozen in a lake at the center of hell, here we see how Dante renders poetic justice. The devil may be the terrifying winged king of hell, but he's also its prisoner. He's simultaneously a king and a slave. So, that's the stereotypical image of the devil, that fallen angel, the winged, fiery king of hell. But not all cultures share this view of the devil. In fact, not all cultures see the devil as a bad guy. What do I mean by that? That's a good question. In Western Guatemala, curious shrines can be found. They are small, usually one-roomed. Bottles of alcohol, money, and cigars are scattered across the floor. At the center of these shrines is an effigy of a short man dressed in 17th century garb with a cigar hanging out of his mouth. Who is he? He is Maximon, a saint unrecognized by the Catholic Church. He is a combination of Judas, Hernan Cortez, and Mom, the Mayan trickster god. And you go to him for those things that you can't go to Jesus for. Money, a new motorcycle, love.
Pure One, I invoke your presence in the name of holy death. The sign I ask of you, you will give me. The ashes must fall if they wish to speak to me. They must open their mouths, and with this prayer they will come, desperate and full of remorse, to the very soles of my feet. Soul of the four winds, you who wander freely throughout the world, through the seven spirits and the seven souls with the great power of death. He who wanders freely throughout the world, in the streets, hills, and towns, if you encounter his soul, do not let it pass unnoticed until it comes humbly to my feet. If he is sorry, do not let him be alone. Put thoughts of me in his mind. If he is asleep, then let him dream of me. He will not be able to rest in peace because he has heard your sigh in his ears. Amen.
The prayer is called Prayer to the Pure One. Pure One, translated from the Spanish word puro, which can also mean cigar. So we could also call it Prayer to the Cigar. Remember, Maximon always has a cigar hanging out of his mouth. So, is he the devil? I can't really answer that question. The Catholic Church most certainly regards him as the devil, but his worshippers see him as a sort of saint, or at least someone who knows a saint. One thing's for sure, if you have a statue of Maximon in your house, you better not throw it out, just in case. We're probably going to have to engage in a ton of speculation to figure out Maximon's origin, but he probably comes from some Jesuit missionary who told an indigenous Mayan that their god Mom was the same person as Judas. Of course, what this Jesuit did not realize was that Mom was a trickster god, not an evil god. So by telling the indigenous people that Mom was Judas, this hapless missionary was inadvertently telling them to worship Judas. Over time, Hernan Cortez got wrapped up in Maximon, and that's something that I think is really cool about him. He not only preserves the memory of pre-colonial religion, but he preserves the catastrophe that led to the end of that religion as well. So is Maximon the devil? I can't answer that. It depends on your definition of the devil. And now, Russia! Medieval Russia was a pagan place. The Russians worshipped these folk demons called Chert. They were tricksy things. You needed to be vigilant, lest they harm you in some way. The most common Chert, the Domovoy, house spirits, needed to be kept happy. You shouldn't whistle indoors, lest you disrupt the Domovoy. Just as Mom was a trickster, not necessarily evil, Chert were not the devils of Dante or demons of hell. They were sneaky. They could be malicious, but they could also be outwitted. So when Russia converted to Christianity, belief in Chert persisted. These superstitions about them still exist in Russia today. If you ever go to Russia, do not whistle indoors, or at least don't let a superstitious babushka hear you. Of course, Russians were aware that their Cherts clashed with the church's image of the devil. None were more aware than the masters of Russian literature. Fyodor Dostoevsky has many characters who exhibit devilish qualities, but in his magnum opus, The Brothers Karamazov, the devil himself makes an appearance.
And so, he was sitting there now, almost aware of being delirious.
Wait, I should give you some backstory. In The Brothers Karamazov, one of the brothers, Ivan, is an unrepentant atheist and nihilist. For him, God does not exist, and therefore morality does not exist. He's the character who throws a wrench into the grand beliefs of other characters in the novel. Dostoevsky wanted him to be the greatest possible adversary for his own beliefs about the existence of good in the world. Towards the end of the novel, Ivan becomes sick and begins to hallucinate a figure who does not resemble the king of hell we are used to.
And so, he was sitting there now, almost aware of being delirious, and as I have already said, peering persistently at some object on the sofa against the opposite wall. Someone suddenly turned out to be sitting there, though God knows how he had got in, because he had not been in the room when Ivan Fyodorovich came back from seeing Smerdyakov. It was some gentleman, or rather, a certain type of Russian gentleman, no longer young, qui frisait la cinquantaine, as the French say, with not too much gray in his dark, rather long and still thick hair, and with a pointed beard. He was wearing a sort of brown jacket, evidently from the best of tailors, but already shabby, made approximately 3 years ago and already completely out of fashion, such as no well-to-do man of society had been seen in for at least 2 years.
Okay, so this guy certainly isn't the devil we all know and love. He's wearing last season's fashions. He's kind of a nobody. He's certainly pathetic. He's definitely more of a chert than devil. But that's intentional on Dostoevsky's part. Dostoevsky is writing at the end of the 19th century, on the cusp of modernity, and the image of the devil as the king of fire and brimstone isn't as effective as it used to be. Weapons of war and factories are able to produce fire and brimstone right here on Earth. Maybe that old image of the devil is a little outdated. So the devil and Ivan have a conversation that mostly revolves around the devil trying to convince Ivan that he is real and not just a hallucination. And he reveals his thoughts and his desires. He's agnostic, and all he wants is to be real and have a normal life.
Like you, I myself suffer from the fantastic, and that is why I love your earthy realism. Here you have it all outlined, here you have the formula, here you have geometry, and with us it's all indeterminate equations. I walk about here and dream. I love to dream. Besides, on Earth I become superstitious. Don't laugh, please. That is precisely what I like, that I become superstitious. Here I take on all your habits. I've come to love going to the public baths. Can you imagine that? I love having a steam bath with merchants and priests. My dream is to become incarnate, but so that it's final, irrevocable, in some fat 250-pound merchant's wife, and to believe everything she believes. My ideal is to go into a church and light a candle with a pure heart. By God, it's true. That would put an end to my sufferings. I've also come to love getting medical treatment here. There was smallpox going around this spring, so I went to the Foundling Hospital and had myself inoculated against smallpox. If only you knew how pleased I was that day. I donated 10 rubles for our brother Slavs.
Dostoevsky is known for his murders and melodrama, but I think he is first and foremost a humorist. I mean, this devil is hilarious. He loves getting inoculated against smallpox. But what makes him funny also makes him terrifying. This is a time when scores of people are dying from the disease, and the devil takes perverse pleasure in it. This devil is not impotent. Instead, he's a kind of demonic mirror image of Ivan's beliefs.
See, Yvonne believes that if he throws away God and morality, he can become a better man, a stronger man. The devil shows Yvonne that his beliefs do not lead to a better, stronger version of man, but instead lead to the pathetic sponger whose form the devil has taken. At the end of their conversation, the devil goes in for the kill.
Judging by the enthusiasm with which you deny me, the gentleman laughed, I'm convinced that you do believe in me all the same. Not in the least. Not for 100 part do I believe in you. But for 1,000th part you do believe. Homeopathic doses are perhaps the strongest. Admit that you do believe, let's say for 1,000th part. Not for 1 moment, Yvonne cried in a rage. And by the way, I should like to believe in you, he suddenly added strangely.
This is a really confusing section. Why does the devil want Yvonne to have faith in him? And why is he talking about homeopathy? As an adolescent, Dostoevsky became very sick with a throat ailment. His father, a doctor, tried everything, but 19th century medicine wasn't very effective. In desperation, he turned to a homeopathic cure popular at the time. The cure was a low dose of poison. It didn't work, and Dostoevsky's voice was permanently scarred. So is the devil trying to cure Yvonne or poison him? Are they the same thing? We will never find out. Yvonne slips into a coma, and the novel ends without saying whether he survives. The playful, toying, yet incredibly dangerous devil developed as Russian literature entered the 20th century. He appears again in Mikhail Bulgakov's truly marvelous work, The Master and Margarita. The novel takes place in Stalinist Russia, not a great time for writing, and it opens on two members of the literary society having a conversation at Patriarch's Pond, a park in Moscow. Both are talentless hacks who owe their successes solely to sucking up to the state. In their mind, the state has eradicated superstition, religion, and fairy tales, and replaced it with cold, hard rationalism. Sounds boring, no? A stranger appears before them and engages them in a conversation they find bizarre.
Astonishing, exclaimed the uninvited discussant, and then, looking around furtively for some reason and muffling his already low voice, he said, Excuse my persistence, but did I understand you to say that you don't believe in God either? He made his eyes pop in mock fright and added, I swear I won't tell anyone. That's right, we don't believe in God, answered Berlioz with a faint smile at the tourist's fear. But we can talk about it freely and openly. The foreigner leaned back on the bench and practically squealed with curiosity as he asked, You mean you're atheists? Yes, we are, answered Berlioz with a smile, while Bezdomny thought in irritation, He's sticking to us like glue, the foreign pest. Oh, how delightful, cried the amazed foreigner, turning to look first at one writer and then the other. In our country, atheism comes as no surprise to anyone, said Berlioz in a polite and diplomatic way. The majority of our population made a conscious decision long ago not to believe the fairy tales about God. Here the foreigner made the following move. He got up, pressed the astonished editor's hand, and uttered these words. Allow me to thank you with all my heart. What are you thanking him for? Queried Bezdomny, blinking. For very important information that I, as a traveler, find extraordinarily interesting, explained the eccentric from abroad, raising his finger in a meaningful way. The important information had apparently made a really strong impression on the traveler, since he anxiously scanned the surrounding buildings, as if in fear of spotting an atheist in every window. No, he's not English, thought Berlioz, while Bezdomny wondered, where in hell did he learn to speak Russian like that? That's what I'd like to know. And he scowled again.
As you guessed, the stranger is really the devil. Not that these imagination-devoid writers can tell. And he proceeds to wreak havoc. By the end of his stay in Moscow, the Soviet literary establishment is in chaos, and quite a few people end up with their heads removed from their body. Some do survive this ordeal. I won't explain how, though. Spoilers. Both Dostoevsky and Bulgakov's devils do not cause physical anguish, but mental anguish. They challenge the beliefs and ideologies we hold dear. They cause us to doubt the fundamental truths upon which we build our existences. They remind us that those structures can collapse. Sometimes they pull out a brick.
Baninga yamboka oyo baninga Boyo kaningo malako aye
Finally, let's go to Haiti, in New Orleans, and look at a case of mistaken identity. Both Haiti and New Orleans have fascinating histories. Both were French colonies,
Haiti was formed when, for the first time ever, slaves successfully revolted against their masters and declared independence. New Orleans is the birthplace of blues and jazz and has some of the best food in the world. Both also share a religion, voodoo. When you think of voodoo, you probably think of sticking pins into little dolls that look like people, but that image is utterly and completely wrong. Voodoo comes from the religions of the West African Fon and Uwe people, brought by slaves across the Atlantic. Voodoo worships gods called Loa, who fall under the command of the supreme god, Papabonde. Loas became associated with Catholic saints. Voodoo places a huge amount of significance on dance and possession, the idea being that you can actually become a Loa while dancing. We see this in Isabel Allende's novel, The Island Beneath the Sea.
In my 40 years, I, Zarita Sedea, have had better luck than other slaves. I am going to have a long life, and my old age will be a time of contentment, because my star, Mes Étoiles, also shines when the night is cloudy. I know the pleasure of being with the man my heart has chosen. His large hands awaken my skin. I have had 4 children and a grandson, and those who are living are free. My first memory of happiness, when I was just a bony, runny-nosed, tangle-haired little girl, is moving to the sound of the drums. And that is also my most recent happiness, because last night I was in the place Congo dancing, and dancing without a thought in my head, and today my body is warm and weary. Music is a wind that blows away the years, memories, and fear, that crouching animal I carry inside me. With the drums, the everyday Zarite disappears, and I am again the little girl who danced when she barely knew how to walk. I strike the ground with the soles of my feet, and life rises up my legs, spreads up my skeleton, takes possession of me, drives away distress, and sweetens my memory. The world trembles. Rhythm is born on the island beneath the sea. It shakes the earth. It cuts through me like a lightning bolt and rises toward the sky, carrying with it my sorrows so that Papa Bondi can chew them, swallow them, and leave me clean and happy. The drums conquer fear. The drums are the heritage of my mother, the strength of Guinea that is in my blood. No one can harm me when I am with the drums. I become as overpowering as Air Zuli, Loa of Love, and swifter than the bullwhip. The shells on my wrists and ankles click in time. The gourds ask questions. The djembe drums answer in the voice of the jungle, and the timbales with their tin tones. The junjuns that know how to speak make the invitation, and the big mama roars when they beat her to summon the Loas. The drums are sacred. The Loas speak through them.
It was easy for those who did not understand voodoo to view it as devil worship. Easy to believe that these dancers were not communing with their gods, but being possessed by demons or the devil himself. This case of mistaken identity still exists today in the West's popular image of voodoo, particularly in regards to one Loa, Papa Legba.
You're Papa Legba. You live in a chicken shack?
No, darling. It's not the hell. It's your hell.
That's a clip from American Horror Story, the American TV series. And in it, Papa Legba is portrayed as the devil, which really upset a lot of people who believe in voodoo. Papa Legba is the Loa of the crossroads, the connection between our world and the world of the Loa. He speaks all human languages. He's most certainly not evil, but he is often mistaken for the devil. The devil often appears at crossroads. Dante is at the crossroads of his life when he makes his way into hell. The legend goes that when the devil appeared to blues musician Robert Johnson at the crossroads, he sold his soul in exchange for the ability to play guitar like none other. But just as how the Catholic Church writes Maximon off as the devil without really examining him, so do those who view Legba as the devil, and voodoo as devil worship. Voodoo is a remarkable religion that survived the horrors of slavery, and it does not deserve the ignorant representation it gets in today's Western culture. I'm looking at you, Scooby-Doo the movie. It's a religion that led to the creation of jazz. Allende's character Zarite talks about gathering in the place Congo. That's a real place in New Orleans. It's called Congo Square. and it was a place where slaves would gather, play drums, and dance. It's a place where Zarite is able to let the Loas possess her. Congo Square was an important part of slave culture, and after the end of slavery, it continued to be a place for music and dance. Eventually, European brass instruments joined the drums, and a new genre of music, jazz, was born. The devil is not always evil, or sometimes what we think is the devil may not actually be the devil. Whenever you see something that resembles him, don't be afraid to take a closer look. And last but not least, the Joker. I did some research into his origins, and I was really surprised by what I found out. He was conceived in America in the 1930s, but a lot of the inspiration for him came from Victor Hugo's The Hunchback of Notre Dame, a French novel. A lot of the inspiration for him also came from a German film, The Man Who Laughs, which is based on another Victor Hugo novel. But the most important inspiration for the Joker came from the Joker playing card, and playing cards have a complicated history. The first playing cards were created in China in the 9th century, then migrated to Persia, and then to Mamluk Egypt in the 11th century. From there, they ended up in Europe in the 13th century. Europeans took them across the Atlantic to America, and finally, in 1933, one of the playing cards inspired the creation of one of the most enduring comic book villains in history. We have this idea of world literature as the genre you go to when you want to read a book written in another language. But as the Joker's 9th century Chinese origins show, all literature is world literature. Cultures constantly merge with other cultures. There is no such thing as literature untouched by other literature. As the world grapples with rapidly weakening borders and influxes of refugees, it's easy to turn our backs, to say that these people are not like us. But these people are our people. There are parts of their culture in our own. World literature is not a word for books written in other languages. It's a celebration of the currents that bring languages together. Thanks for listening. The Book of Job was translated by Robert Alter. The passage from the New Testament is from the King James Version. The Inferno was translated by the great Robert Pinksy. Prayer to the Pure One was translated by my dad, Stephen Goulden. The Brothers Karamazov was translated by the legendary Richard Pevere and Larissa Volokhonsky. The Master and Margarita was translated by Diana Bergen and Catherine Tiernan O'Connor. And The Island Beneath the Sea was translated by Margaret Sayers Pendon. You can find Amazon links to all of the books we read on our website, asymptote.com/blog/podcast, and you can buy them there or at your local bookstore. Special thanks to our voice actors, Piali Sham, Alessio Franco, and Emily Hooper, and a very special thanks to our audio editor, Sally Decker, who will be leaving us after this episode. We wish her the best. This has been the Asymptote Podcast. I've been Daniel Goulden. We'll see you next month.